The Bill Myers Show podcast is sponsored by Clouser Drilling. They've been leading the way in Southern Oregon well drilling for over 50 years. Find out more about them at clouserdrilling.com.
Here's Bill Myers.
10 minutes after 6, it is Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Join the conversation, 770-5633, 770-KMED. Email Bill at BillMyersShow.com. The Facebook.com feed is up for as long as it lasts. I don't know. Sometimes they just dump out. Meta doesn't like what we talk about. I don't know, but I like what we talk about. You can join that conversation. Hey, I wanted to just give a quick note here to recognize Joel from the Iron Gate. Joel Carpenter, I think, was his last name. I had mailed him a couple of times over the years. I was informed yesterday that Joel ended up passing away day before last night. He would call the program every now and then. And he was not a young man, of course, and I didn't know if there were any particular health problems going on with him, but we all shuck the mortal coil at some point. And Joel, just wanted to say RIP, and thanks for the contact and keeping us informed with what was going on over at the Iron Gate. Just wanted to recognize that, okay? Joel Carpenter. Have some good news here I wanted to mention this morning. And like I said, you're always looking for some green shoots in the state of Oregon, because Oregon, as I mentioned yesterday, and nothing like that has changed. It's still bat guano crazy for the most part. That's just the way it is. But Department of Housing and Urban Development announced yesterday that non-permanent residents are no longer going to be eligible for FHA mortgages. In other words, illegal aliens will no longer be getting FHA home loans. Okay. I'm sure Attorney General Dan Rayfield will probably be filing a lawsuit about this, too, because I swear that's all that Attorney General Dan Rayfield knows how to do. It's like, Trump is doing something. He's being mean. He's not going to give FHA loans to people buying houses in Oregon. No, people buying houses in Oregon can still get an FHA loan. You can't be an illegal alien. But we're a sanctuary state. That's your problem, Dan. Actually, it's our problem, too, for that matter. It would be really interesting if the Trump administration sours the federal milk to the point where maybe even the state of Oregon will decide maybe that sanctuary state kind of stuff isn't going to be working. You know, lack of money and cutting off the sugar from Uncle Sugar probably will have a way of sharpening the mind, don't you think? Or likely could have a way. Well, I don't know. Do you think Oregon is when I talk about Oregon, I'm not talking about you and me. I'm talking about the state power structure, democratically controlled. Do you think if you cut enough money out of the Oregon budget that they would actually, you know, maybe we can't be so insane? A fellow can dream, right? It is Conspiracy Theory Thursday. All right. Now then, another executive order of the Trump administration that Dan Rayfield, once again, Dan Rayfield, I think, has like just a stamp that says suing Trump, and then he puts it on the speed dial, and then he puts it out in the press releases. But Oregonian reporting that President Donald Trump has his far-reaching executive order Tuesday would require individuals to provide proof of citizenship to register to vote and prevent states like Oregon from counting mail-in ballots received after Election Day, which I say, again, common sense. And so now they're going over this right now. Secretary of State Tobias Reed, who oversees the Oregon elections, says the fundamental aim of Trump's order was to make it more difficult for people to vote. Now, I would rephrase that. Now, of course, Secretary of State Tobias Reed is a rabid partisan, even though he's considered a moderate as far as Democrats are going. But make it more difficult for people to vote? No, I would say make it more difficult for Oregonians to cheat. Or maybe it's for Democrats to cheat, although who knows? It could be Republicans doing election cheating, too. Cheating is not a monopartisan kind of thing. It's definitely a bipartisan thing. But Tobias Reed says, we know voter ID laws have a pretty chilling impact on voter registration. Well, yeah, if you don't ask for any ID to vote, you get lots and lots of registration. Lots of fake registration, lots of foreign people. Hey, this is the state, what, that registered illegal aliens routinely. They finally admitted it. Well, they've admitted to a few of them. Something tells me there's a lot more to it. I don't know. So they're going to sue against that, too. Most likely going to face election challenges or court challenges. You know, I can't wait to see Tobias Reid and the Dan Rayfield types, you know, up there in front of federal judges trying to explain why in a world that requires all sorts of ID, even just to cash a check or to open a bank account, to get your benefits, all these various other things, that somehow the burden to prove that you are a legal citizen is too much. We have to do it to do state ID. In fact, real ID is going to be cranking up here May 7th. It's going to be the deadline, all these kind of things. But, hey, they're not saying anything about that. That's all right. But for somehow actually providing identification in order to be able to vote is just beyond the pale. Now, I know what they're going to say. They're going to say things like that, well, you know, having to jump through hoops to, you know, for our constitutional right, that's bad. Oh, okay. Can we get rid of the background checks in here to buy a firearm? Shut up! You know, that's how that would go, right? Yeah, what about all the hoops that the Democrats want we people who have a Second Amendment in this country to actually go get a firearm? We'll talk about that more, too. Kevin Starrett will rejoin me with the latest in the carnage and some of the battles going on, including the federal courts. Even the federal court decisions right now are not looking particularly good. Ghost guns. Oh, I love that. You know, they talk about ghost guns. Here it is. This is a country in which people have built guns and made homemade guns from the very beginning, the very founding of this nation. And the Biden administration ended up saying, oh, no, you can't do that. And the Supreme Court went along with it. Sometimes I wonder if you get the feeling that the fix is in even on the so-called conservative Supreme Court that we're always told to be. Oh, man, at least we got the Supreme Court. That ghost gun thing makes you wonder, doesn't it? All right, so we got Rayfield. We got the deportation. Oh, this is the other great story, too. That judge that ruled against Trump in the deportation flights, James Boasberg, who, by the way, I think was a Bush appointee, right? Not Obama. Could be wrong about that. I'll have to look that up again. But the same judge that ruled against Trump in the Venezuelan deportation flights thing, and of course the Venezuelans ended up getting deported anyway. They're just gone. But he is going to handle a brand new lawsuit alleging that Trump officials violated federal law by talking about that attack in the Signal chat. This is the Pete Hegseth lawsuit. I guess there's been a lawsuit that was filed. The new lawsuit alleges that the Trump officials' use of Signal, of a platform that allows messages about government business to be erased, is a violation of record retention laws. Huh. All right, so before anyone in the Trump administration would be able to get together and chat about. Now, see, this was a chat. I didn't think this was an official government meeting, but apparently there may be some law about this. Can officials no longer get together and chat about something off the record without submitting it to a federal judge? I guess we're going to find out with James Boasberg and his case over the next few weeks. Oh, my gosh. Like I said, just mentally ill news every day is kind of like you get some good news and then you get the mentally ill news and it's all in there. All right. 19 minutes after 6, E.J. Snyder is going to join me here in just a few minutes. One of the world's number one extreme survivalists. He was one of the premier people on Naked and Afraid. That's a brave soul to go on Naked and Afraid. But well, I'll talk with him here in just a few minutes.
Hi, I'm Lisa with Kelly's Automotive Service and I'm on KMED.
E.J. Snyder, world's number one extreme survivalist, adventurer, 25-year retired decorated Army combat veteran. I don't think he's the type of guy that that writes children's books, unless it's children's books about how to get home safely. And actually, he has a brand new book out here called Emergency Home Preparedness. E.J., welcome to the show. How you doing, sir?
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having me. Welcome, America, for having me as well. Thanks to everyone out there who've been big fans of mine and supported me over the years. And thanks for having me, fellas.
Now, E.J. Snyder, you were on Naked and Afraid. So you were like one of the first people. Were you the first people on it? The first ones to get naked for the camera?
I was recruited by Discovery, actually, for that reason. 12 years ago, we filmed the pilot episode, Tanzania, Africa. Myself, a woman I didn't know, Kelly Nightlinger, a couple items. And we were out there. Nobody, not us, not the crew, nobody knew what we were doing. And we soldiered through it, for lack of a better term, no pun intended.
Yeah.
And now we have this hit series that I've been on 6 times, 206 days, no taps, and I've never quit, and one right spear testicle.
Oh, well, good. Glad to hear that. Thank you for the testicle reference here. Hey, just wanted to touch in here. Do you think the military training, a little bit on your military background, if you don't mind, do you think that helps on that kind of a story? You know, you get together on a survival story, but you're naked there. You know, if you're in the military, you can't have any shyness about the body, right? Would that be a fair assessment, how that works?
Very fair. It's not a... the military is not a job for the weak of heart. Let's just say that.
Yeah, I would imagine not here. Hey, what is different about your emergency preparedness book here, EJ? Because there's a lot of them, and I know a lot of people will read emergency books, and I think this is great. I love to collect them, and so I'm adding yours to my collection. But what do you think makes yours different? I have an idea. I have a thought that makes it different, but why don't you break it down for me if you could?
Well, it's very, this book, and I've been training survival, and I'm not looking to make the next Bear Grylls or Cody Lundin. Mm-hmm. I want to make you the best you can be. So I train and do everything in survival, whether it's a live class or writing or books or podcasts, and I talk at the level of the everyday Joe or Joan.
Yeah.
And so after the pandemic, we learned that the U.S., 90% of the U.S. just stayed home, and they really weren't prepared to do that after the pandemic. And then 10% bugged out. Half of them just bugged out somewhere else to bug in, and they were still in the same situation. Then there's the other half that are like me that could go to the woods with just a knife and live out there. So we started with a video, and as we got the video out there, the ultimate bug-in home defense guy, people loved it, and they were like, is this in a written form that we can have it on the shelf, look at it, and get ready? And we realized, hey, let's put this in a book. Let's make it in a format that's easy to understand, step by step, and it's done very well. And when you read it, it's easy to read. We've got good lists in there that help you get ready. And we just want people to be prepared for whether it's the next pandemic, civil unrest, war, natural disaster, or the zombie apocalypse.
Yeah, do you ever look at the news and think that your book is going to get used sooner rather than later someday?
I do. And the big problem is, people, after the whatever it was that passed, whether it was the pandemic, the fires in L.A., the hurricanes that hit North Carolina, once they get the smoke clears and people think, oh, or a tornado comes through town, oh, that's not going to happen again. And then they just put it on the back shelf, and then all of a sudden it happens again. They're like, oh, I should have did better. And we have a motto at Survival Mastery, one of my companies, is called, don't be scared, be prepared. When you're prepared, you have confidence. You instill confidence in your family and your loved ones, and it's just smart. If you stock up your garage full of shelves with these supplies and you never get to them, at least you have them when you need them most. And then all of a sudden that day comes and you're like, I'm so glad I got EJ's book and got ready.
Yeah, exactly. The one thing that I really liked about your book is that many people talk about bug out, bugging out, bugging out, bugging out. Now, in certain cases, yeah, that might be the case. Then you end up being part of a huge refugees. You're a refugee, essentially, is what you are at that point.
Yes, you are.
But
yes, you are.
90% plus of us, I think. In fact, the subtitle of your book, Emergency Home Preparedness, is the ultimate guide for bugging in during natural disasters, pandemics, civil unrest, and more. Because most people don't have a bug out cabin. And most of us would probably have to stay home. And I thought that was what made your book a lot different. And I appreciated that because I think that's where most people are. What say you about that take on it?
No, that's a solid observation. That's exactly why we did it. Because like I said earlier, we know that most of the U.S., they were forced to stay home in many cases, but they did. And your home is your castle. Your home is where you mentally feel safe. Excuse me, where you mentally feel, you know, you're safe, You're confident. You know, it's familiar. Mm-hmm. And it's already could be a tough situation. A lot of people don't do well with tough mental challenges or they're put to task. I'm the opposite. You tell me I'm going to be locked in my 3,600 square foot house. All of a sudden, that becomes a 10 by 10 cell to me. And I'm going to run to the woods. I'm going to go where it's open spaces and I can handle my own situation. But a lot of people, they got to get the basics together and they don't put the right timeline. They think, oh, I just need 72 hours. And you hear commercials about these survival foods. And you need 72 hours or that's what the CDC recommends. No, you need a minimum of 3 weeks. And then once you get 3 weeks, get to a month, then get 3 months, then get to 6 months. You got a 6 month food supply with food and water, and you could stretch it out. If you go one meal a day, you've got 6 months. Now you have 18 months.
Yeah. One thing about that, though, is
that's what we talk about.
Now, would it be fair to say a big mistake that people make is talking about it? It's kind of like a Fight Club. You know, if you got your big pantry, your big supplies and things like that, you don't talk about it, do you?
No, you stay the gray man. I just was seeing a little clip last night on Instagram, which is something I preach is, if your house is outside, let's say this thing's getting really bad, mm-hmm. Well, go break a few pieces of furniture, throw that out in your front lawn, throw some trash out there, you know, throw some sheets out there, make it look like someone's already looted through your house, so you're putting up the facade so that you don't become a target of potential looters and people want to do bad things, because that's going to come up. And another big mistake people make is prescription drugs and eyeglasses. You know, I always say have a backup to the backup.
Yep.
But there's not going to be any drug stores if the world flips. So you better make sure you're prepared with whatever medications you have long term.
Hey, I got to tell you, that is a big takeaway on that, too, from emergency home preparedness. By the way, what is it? Two is one and having one is none, right? that's the way you attend.
That's a Ranger term that we use in the Army.
Yep, indeed. Great book. I think this is a winner. I like the fact that you're helping people prepare to bug in. That's where most people are. And it's not necessarily get out of town bag, a get home bag, you know, that sort of thing. Right. It's the ultimate guide for bugging in during natural disasters, pandemic, civil unrest, and more. Available at the usual suspects, but you can also head to your website, ejsnyder.com, and you'll sign it for the folks, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yep. They go up there, they can get a signed copy. And like I said, all things survival. I teach survival. You'll find classes over there. And then my new company, survivalmastery.co, if you lose a little EJ2025, you'll get a discount. And we are over there teaching people survival outdoor skills online in lots of classes, not just survival, but everything mindset, preparedness as well. So, yeah, don't be scared. Be prepared.
All right. EJ Snyder, thanks for being here and having that particular set of skills. Okay? You be well. Take care.
You guys stay safe.
Sure will. EJ Snyder, once again, Emergency Home Preparedness. I'll put the information up. I think I'll have access on my KMED.com website again. Been having a problem with the login, but we'll get the blogs going again for sure. This is the Bill Myers Show.
Thanks, Jan. I'm out here on location looking at a roof that needs to be replaced. Here's your future weather forecast if you have a roof like this one. Brought to you by our new sponsor, Fontana Roofing. And they're right on time. Nice.
Financing excludes tax, license, title, and 250 dealer doc fees. See dealer for details.
The Bill Myers Show on 106.3 KMED.
637. Every now and then I get a chance to talk to someone I've never had a chance to speak with before. It's great having EJ Snyder on a few minutes ago, talking survivalist. And now we're going to get into the culture battle here a little bit. And with a gentleman who I have not had the pleasure of speaking with before, but a friend of mine, Sandy, got me set up with Greg Rabideaux. And he's an award-winning filmmaker and author and has a website. You can check him out and see what he's up to. It's GregTheFilmmaker.com, GregTheFilmmaker.com. I like that. It's pretty simple. Even I could remember that here, Greg. Welcome to the program. Good to have you on.
A pleasure to be here, Bill. Thank you.
All right. So you have decided to expand beyond, I guess, beyond filmmaking and then getting into the culture wars and maybe punditry about that. Well, tell me a little bit about your background. What kind of films have you done? Is it documentary? Is it drama? Just break it down if you could, please.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So we've been specializing really in documentary films the last several years. And so we've been looking at things like stolen babies, smuggling, sex trafficking, some tough stuff. One of our films, Stolen Babies of Spain, focused on that, which was going on for decades. And then we kind of helped shed a real spotlight on it. And it did get some legislation and it did get some more focus. And then we focused on one person that was trying to find his own biological background and his biological mom. And it brought us all the way to the Vatican and the Pope, the current Pope that's been Francis, that's been battling illnesses and all. And so we filmed a meeting between him, the Pope, and this other gentleman in that film. And then we looked at some things. We have a film that we're doing, a docudrama and also a script. So a narrative film based on it, and it's based on a local story here. And when I say here, I'm in Myrtle Beach area in South Carolina, of a very, let's just say, highly suspicious, very emotion-packed incident, which ended in the death of a young woman who was married to, at that time, a pastor who was in an evangelical, leading evangelical church. And it's caused a real big uprising here, and it got some national attention. So we've got a script on that. We're doing a docudrama on that story as well. And then we've also done some comedy, some lighthearted stuff. You got to kind of...
Yeah, because, I mean, everything else you've been talking about here, Greg, sounded like serious as a heart attack, supposedly, right?
Yeah, so you got to go, okay, before I just wake up crying every morning, it'd be nice to do something funny. So we did a short film about basically a college grad who's hanging out, sitting at the couch, playing video games, and his mom gives him an ultimatum. You got 5 days, get a real job, or I'm booting your rear end out the door. And he basically goes to his friends, not such a good idea. And his friends were doing the same thing for advice, and then that's kind of that comedy. And so we've got that in the works, but we're looking at that other script right now. And, you know, part of it is, as I'm sure you know, Bill, a lot of it is you can write wonderful scripts. You can have all the great crew, talent, vision. You got to get investments. You know, you got to get the back.
Well, yeah, you got to be able to to make it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you got to be able to make that that pencil. I wanted to ask you, you know, since you've made so many documentaries, and by the way, before we get on to the documentaries in Snow White, I especially wanted to talk with you about that, given this has been a big bomb and a stinko in the media, and get your take on it. Comedy is much harder than a documentary, wouldn't you say? And I shouldn't say harder, but comedy's hard, isn't it? Really?
No, yeah. I mean, absolutely. You had, Charlie Chaplin, who was sort of the father in some ways of certainly the silent films, but comedy, a lot of physical comedy. Yeah, and he was always asked about this too. And what he said still holds true today. You know, great comedy looks easy, looks simple, but it's the hardest damn thing to do in the world. And I would agree in the sense of, like, when we shoot comedy scenes, So I do a lot of the original script writing. So in my head, in my, you know, fevered, warped brain, I see something and I think it's hilarious. And then I'll try to get it on paper, and then we'll do usually an early reading, and I'll just try to get a feel for what people other than me think. And if they go, yeah, this is funny, the process of getting it from your head into paper, from paper into filming is hard. And the timing is really challenging. So you end up having to do usually a lot of takes until it just feels right. And it's always, you always cross your fingers with this kind of stuff and hope that audiences go, yeah, that's really funny, and they share it. And that's why in one hand, I understand why the big studios go with the brand names and they go with something like the Snow White, because they think, hey, of course, everybody knows Snow White. But when you go from a classic animated, phenomenal movie for so many reasons in 1937, which really put Disney on the map. I mean, they had the little Steamboat Willie and the little animated cartoon that introduced Mickey a few years earlier, but it was Snow White that really built the house of Disney. And then you go from that to a live action with diverse transgender dwarfs, and then you go CGI.
Now, I did not see the movie. Hold on. I just want to make sure. Greg.
Yes, sir.
Is this, I did not read up much on this movie because I had no interest in going to see a Disney movie. I haven't had an interest in going to Disney for a long, long time. Disney destroyed Star Wars, as far as I'm concerned. Okay. you know, all that baloney of, you know, even Luke back in the original had to do some studying and training. And then when they get to the female Star Wars stars, then it has to be, hey, I'm just born with all this knowledge. Isn't this great? The Force was born within me. But anyway, so I don't go to Disney films, period.
I hear you.
Now, you're telling me, really, transgender dwarves.
Yeah, so what they did, initially, and this is why the film started to already get some well-deserved bad press and karma, okay, was already what happened is they, and this is normal, this side's normal. You develop some things, you do some still shots, you do some publicity still shots of on-set casting, you start doing a few scenes and you send that out. You kind of send that to the press, start whetting their appetite. So what they did is they did this of the dwarfs, but the dwarfs they chose, they basically said, what kind of rainbow in terms of society can we get for dwarfs?
Uh-huh.
And I guess from their viewpoint, virtue signal just as much as possible. Well, I mean, that came out and there was a lot of backlash and basically a lot of people going, what in the world are you doing? Okay. Now, here's how bad it got, though. You may not know who by name the actor Peter Dinklage is, but he is a dwarf. And so he knows a thing or two about dwarfism. He is one of the actors that was in Game of Thrones.
Okay.
And
all
so
right.
It gets bad when he says, why the F, I'm cleaning it up a bit, did Disney decide it was a good movie to take the classic 1937 animated, update it to 2025, and stick a young woman in a dark cave with seven dwarfs, and then decide not even to use live dwarfs and go CGI generated. Mm-hmm. And that's how bad it got. When you lose your dwarf constituency on a film about seven Snow White and the seven dwarfs, you're doing something wrong.
I mean, is it too hard to hide dwarves? Is it that rare that there aren't many dwarf actors? I don't know.
Oh, good Lord, no.
Okay.
No, and the point he was making and the larger point is that it's always a risk when you go from, and full disclosure, I'm not a big fan of going from classic animated that is really successful and strikes a nerve in the sense of it's beloved and a lot of families can go to it and it's family friendly and a lot of kids love it, to, okay, let's go live action. I mean, that's why I didn't like Lion King animated going to live action. I don't want to see live. I don't, that's why I don't turn on the old National Geographic type docs, documentary films on, lions fighting in the woods. I don't want to see it. I don't want to hear about it. I don't want to see it. I don't want to experience it. So what I want is the magic and the make-believe world of the animated. So already it was risky.
And let's face it, The Lion King, as an example, was a perfect film, as far as I'm concerned. It's like, why do you mess with perfection? Why bother? Unless maybe what's happened here, Greg, by the way, I'm speaking with a filmmaker, Greg Rabideau, and is it just that we have run out of ideas at this point and all anyone can do these days is to replumb or re-drill into past successes? How do you see it as a filmmaker yourself?
It's an excellent question, and I'm going to tell you it's natural to think that, but I'm going to take a contrarian point of view a little bit, which is, no, I don't think we've run out of ideas. I think what happens is when studios get myopic and they say, absolutely, we're not going to take any kind of risks, and so we think, however wrong, we think that the name Snow White alone is going to make X amount on our big opening weekend, then we're not going to look at fresh ideas and we're just going to try to reboot, and which is basically what they did. But if you're going to do that, Bill, and you're going to spend, which they ended up spending $272 million on a budget.
Now, wait a minute, $272 million on a Snow White Disney budget, and they didn't even have to hire dwarves, and they spent $270 million. Where did it go?
It goes to crew, it goes to marketing, it goes to actors, it goes to all of the technical behind the scenes, all the cost incurred with making a huge film like that. But if you're going to spend that much money, then you got to do what Sam Goldwyn of the Metro Golden Meyer, the old days, right? The old studios used to say, look, all my actors can have opinions and they can have wonderful thoughts, as long as they keep that to themselves.
Uh-huh.
Because when you get Rachel Zegler, who's sort of this, at the moment, she's one of the it girls.
I don't know much about her, but pretty mouthy from the looks of it, and a Colombian, actress, right?
Yeah, so she was in West Side, the West Side Story reboot. That's, and she can act some, and she can certainly sing. So, but she was seen as sort of the hot property. So she's coming off of West Side Story. I'm sure Disney thought, oh, she's a hot property, right? It doesn't matter, we're going to cast her because the name and people are going to know her from that, and then we're going to put her here. But when you start coming out, I mean, put it this way: when Disney released their film trailer, which is a big launch, sort of a point, number one on the process to really build the buzz around a film. So you release your film trailer. On the day they released the film trailer, she took it upon herself, Rachel Zegler, to make sure the world knew that she wanted a free Palestine and by association, Hamas. And then she had also tweeted the typical, right, F Trump and F his supporters, and may only harm come to them, and may they know no peace. So she's out there firing all this stuff up. At the same time, Disney is trying to market her in the movie as pure and virtuous and innocent and beloved. So I get, believe me, that people, you know, actors are people, just like Golden said, they have their opinions and thoughts, but it's a business, right? So if someone's paying you millions of dollars, and they want you to portray a certain character both on and off the camera, at least as long as the film's being marketed, right, to keep that magic going, just do it. That's the business you're in. But she couldn't resist. She couldn't help herself. And I guess what made it worse and got even worse press, if you can imagine, and a bigger backlash is, do you know the name Gal Gadot, the actress, the Wonder Woman actress?
Yes.
Gal Gadot.
Yeah, and, okay. and she was essentially blacklisted for her political views, right?
Right. So she's Israeli born. She served in the Israeli armed forces. She's been an outspoken critic of Hamas. She was, after October 7th, she it seemed like she stood almost alone in the wilderness of Hollywood saying, hey, we need to put some resources towards the victims of October 7th, and not just what many of you are doing is saying, you know, let's look at both sides. And she's saying, where's the other side to this terrible slaughtering of October 7th? So her co-star, Rachel Zegler, who has said, hey, Gal Gadot is a mentor of mine, I admire her, another female actor that's made it big. So that's how you repay her, or that's how you express that worship or admiration, by posting that when you know your co-star is having her stance and her ancestry. It's almost like, hey, there's an open wound, let me throw salt on it.
Yeah, lots of it. And rub it, by the way. Rub it in, not just throw it on there. And, oh, my gosh. Yeah, rub it in with steel wool, I guess. Filmmaker Greg Rabideau with me this morning. Hey, Greg, I'm wondering what role social media plays in this, because, you know, now it has just become so easy that that people are just supposed to vomit their thoughts out without a whole lot of thinking. And do you think that even Rachel Zegler, even though I think she's, you know, kind of an anti-American screed maker or whatever, but do you think that that social media makes it much, much easier to screw yourself over like Rachel Zegler apparently did?
Yeah, no, it's a great point. I mean, let's say I use the sort of the analogy where, let's say you and I are having a coffee or something. We're just chatting and we're throwing, you know, we're BSing to each other, and then we don't think anything more of it, right?
But if everything that you and I BSed about, we're all of a sudden just thrown into an open platform everywhere.
Exactly,
right.
Exactly. So you and I talk a little bit, and then it's done, it's gone, and on to the next day. Well, especially the younger generation, 15, 16, 18, you know, into the 20s, are so used to living, breathing like oxygen with social media and the cell phone constantly. I mean, every thought, every movement, hi, I'm brushing my teeth today kind of thing, that, you know, gets 2 million views. So they're so used to that. That is their form of expression. So there is a chance that just she's so used to it, it was like maybe just gossiping with a couple of her gal pals. But the reality, because at some point you got to grow up, right? You got to know the reality. The reality is you are the face and star of a $270 million film and a multi-billion-dollar franchise. So it's kind of like being the star of a team. And, you know, let's say you just came out of college and you signed this, you know, $25, $50 million contract, and you're now the star quarterback for whatever team you want. Well, you do more than throw a ball, right?
Sure.
You are the face. You're the face. So if you go out and do something stupid or say something stupid or offend half your audience, which she did or more by saying that about the so-called Trump supporters. And I don't mean to digress real quick, Bill, but can we stop with the Trump and his supporters? It's more than half of Americans.
Yeah.
So when you say that, it's not like a small niche movement.
Yeah, well, it's all of a sudden like you're setting fire to half of your potential audience.
And you're burning through half your audience,
yep.
Like with that star quarterback, you already upset maybe half the ticket holder. So, yeah, I get what you're saying with the social media. It is dangerous. It can be very dangerous, and it lives on forever. But Disney realized this. So they sent, I don't know if you know this, they sent, like in the old days it used to happen, a handler. And he flew out from New York to L.A. to basically sit with her and give her the riot act and say, look, you can't do this. This is why. You got to stop it. You got to restrain it. But you know what? I checked as of today, this morning, before you and I talked. She still has the tweet up about the Free Palestine and all of this stuff. So either she stopped or slowed down, but she sure didn't go up and kind of clean up the mess on aisle 7. So who knows if she's learned her lesson. She's on to another movie. I think she's doing Romeo and Juliet reboot now. So we'll see if what she does about Romeo and Juliet. Maybe she'll fire up some tweets about how much of a terrible writer Shakespeare was. Who knows?
Or white supremacy, whatever the case might be. I can't help but think of the late Elvis Presley, who was once asked about politics. He says, I'm just an entertainer. Thank you. Thank you very much. And although he certainly had an opinion, and you end up finding about some of those opinions later on there, but he didn't wear it on his sleeve. Sometimes there's a little bit of wisdom in that. You know, when it comes to films, though, is there any hope for Disney? Because I look at so many misfires in the Disney world like this here, Greg, that I can't help but think that it is baked into their DNA right now to be all woke, all island of misfit humans, not really worrying about any kind of tradition whatsoever. If we don't have the island of misfit humans elevated and starring in the show, we can't make this film. It's like it's almost like the public education system, too, in which mostly white, young, liberal women have come up and have lived in this cultural stew here for the last 20, 25 years or so. And that's all there is. What do you say?
Well, I say this. When we talk culture about any kind of, let's say, company, for example, right? So early on, the culture clearly was imbued by one person. Walter Disney and his brother Roy,
yep.
Disney to a lesser extent. And they had a very clear vision, and he was all about family and entertainment. Now, don't get me wrong. He was a tough SOB. He could be ruthless. He could be cutthroat. He was super efficient with resources, but he had a clear vision, and he basically only wanted people around him that shared his vision. So as they built, he certainly got rid of folks that were in it for themselves or didn't share that vision. And everything was about Disney magic, entertainment, creating memories, bringing people and family back to Disney, whether it was amusement park or movies. Okay, great. So we got that. So what happens is the culture tends to die off literally because the people with the vision like him die off.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got to be kept by people and safeguarded and shepherded through by people that share the same values.
And I don't think it's going to be kept alive by a particular CEO bean counter type.
No. It's not just one person anymore. You can't replace Walt Disney. You can't. But what you can do is you can try to surround yourself with people like he did that share the same vision, that have the same values. What Disney did is similar to what I would say is the modern Democratic Party did, is they started to become completely hostage willingly to a small, very loud, very active, very well financed, very well angry portion of their party. So Disney started to hire people who openly, posted videos about how excited they were that they could now push whatever agenda they wanted to push in every single film. I mean, I recall one video from one of their artists saying she was so excited because she said, in every damn film we make, I'm going to be sure that there is a lesbian in the film. So what you started to get replaced with the Disney magic and family friendly, and it's all about entertainment, was, hey, Disney's a great spot to land if you want to make a political narrative agenda and if you want to make policy via Disney. So then again, like you were just saying, and I was just saying, if you burn half your audience right away with your tweets, well, if already you start making all your movies very heavy with a narrative that only speaks to maybe 5 or 10% at most of who would go, what are the other 90% going? They're going somewhere else.
Yeah.
They're going somewhere else. And like Bud Light, to your question, Bill, I'm not sure they ever come back. Maybe a percentage comes back, but you might have burned them so bad that they are going to get their entertainment or family-friendly films, and we already see this happening with other films and other subjects that are not Disney. So you really just basically threw a whole lot of rotten poison apples on your Disney magic. I'm not sure it comes back, certainly ever, to where it was, but they're going to have to root out. They're going to have to change their culture and focus if they want to get back close to where they were. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and yeah, that does make sense. I'm still wondering why so many parents or grandparents are paying for Disney Plus. I don't get it. Do you?
The name, the brand. I think they're.
You know, and so, in other words, they're playing replays of 1980, right, or 1970, or 1960.
You know,
right?
Movies are a cultural touchstone to many people. I'm sure you can think when you're younger, if there was a movie or a show that you really loved and you go back and you want to get that same good feeling from it. Well, that's, again, why in 1937 when Snow White first came out, you know, it was a phenomenal movie in many ways. The color, the sound, the script, the technical progress in animation, right? You had Judy Garland, you had Marlena Dietrich in the live Carthay Theater, the old theater in L.A., stand up, standing ovation. They had a great feeling about it. Judy Garland says later, years later, she would rewatch it, just what you said, to get that same feeling again. So I get why people initially are like, well, Disney, I'm sure it's got to be great. They're trying. There's a few baby steps into some shows where you can see where they're trying to go back, but they're still, I think, overwhelmed or at least myopic in getting the advice maybe around the table when they screen these and green light certain projects of that, I think, smaller percentage of folks that have a very different worldview than their audience. And that's always dangerous, just like Bud Light. That was not the worldview or the politics of the overwhelming majority of people that liked Bud Light, and they did it anyway.
Yeah.
And when you do those kinds of things, it's self-inflicted. That's what Disney's been doing for the last at least two decades.
You know, in the streaming world that we have now, I don't know if there's as much power with the central studio as it used to be. Do you find that as a filmmaker, and do you see more democratizing of this in which you know, it's no longer going to be the Disney dictating what's going to be the next child hit, et cetera. How do you see it?
I see it. Yeah, no, I think that's an interesting point. As a filmmaker, as an indie filmmaker, we're always looking at the new model. The new business model is really you're collaborative. So, for instance, the script I mentioned before about based on the scandal here where we're at in South Carolina. So what we're looking for would be a collaborative effort of a number of smaller co-production companies that want to do something and have a vision, but they want to do it pretty much the way they want to do it. In other words, they don't necessarily want to say, hey, we really want to tell this story. And then by the time it gets to a studio, they say, no, we're gonna replace live dwarfs with CGI generated.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You don't want to do that. So you're able to
get. You're like, wait a minute. That's not even close to the story. I think the big studios, whenever you can throw around a quarter to a half a billion or more, you're going to have leverage and power, but it's over only certain stories. I mean, look at what dominates the theaters now are essentially superhero comic book stories.
And I think they're running out of ideas there. Seriously. It's
well, when you when you start seeing, you know, things like the Wolverine, you know, five, the, you know, we're going to go back to a reboot of the origin story of Wolverine, or we've already seen three different origin stories of Spider-Man. To your point, you're starting to scrape it. You're starting to scrape that bottom, perhaps. So maybe they'll look at other ideas, but the streaming democratization, I think, is the word used, which is spot on. It at least gives folks like myself and our film studio.
Yeah, you have a shot now, at least, where you go back 20, 30 years, no way.
You couldn't.
Right?
No, no. If you didn't get through, you know, somebody at Paramount, or you didn't get through at somebody at MGM, it wasn't going to get made. Well, now the technology is such that you can make cinema quality films for a much lower price, right? We're not talking about 1940s onset Beverly Hills with a big movie camera that can't even be portable. We're not talking about that. And then we're talking about there are a lot of other opportunities to have your show be seen. That's the good news. The not so good news is, because there's so many, you can end up on a live stream or a channel where...
How do you cut through?
People, yeah, just a few people might be watching, but at least it's a start, and at least it gets you a little bit of the audience to tell your story, too. So you got the big, big tent films, the Mission Impossible franchises, the Avengers, and then you got the reboots of Disney that seem... They just don't get the message. A lot of people don't want to go animated, classic magic to real live action. And then you get a lot of potential opportunities to tell a variety of stories on a lot of these streaming channels. So that's what keeps us going and excited, at least, because, you know, we don't have the wherewithal to do a quarter of a billion type film. But we can hook up and collaborate with other smaller production companies, where we might share a vision and we might be excited about the same story and pool our resources and have it see its light of day, which is our goal and our vision.
Greg, it was a pleasure meeting you. Ran a little bit longer than I thought we would, but you know, it's kind of, I'm not involved in your industry, and so I find it fascinating. And then especially your commentary on how, you know, Disney and some of these other studios just go so wrong and can be so off the mark. You can find out more about Greg and his work at GregTheFilmmaker.com, GregTheFilmmaker.com. And you have commentary up there, too, along with everything else you're doing. Fair enough?
Yeah, fair enough. I appreciate what you do. Thanks so much for letting me talk on about it.
All right. I hope to have you back sometime. When I have questions about cinema, I'm going to you, okay? We'll talk to you later. See you, Greg.
I'm here for you.
Be well. Greg Rabideau. It is KMED, KMED HD1, Eagle Point, Medford, KBXG, Grants Pass.
In 2005, John and Dan acquired Drake's Paint, your local Benjamin Moore dealer, from their fathers. More important than the assets was the cherished family business name. The cousins still work hard every day to honor the name passed down from over a century, symbolizing the values and tradition the Drakes built before them. At Drake's Paint, you get top quality Benjamin Moore paint and stain, and a legacy of service and value preserved for generations. Drake's Paint, your only locally owned paint store in Medford and Grants Pass.
Attention property owners and pro landscapers. Zoll's Lawn and Garden Equipment is stocked with the full Echo lineup,